Premeditatio Malorum. No, this is not a Harry Potter spell. It is a Stoic concept of negative visualization, and that's what Mouse and I are going to talk about on the Broken Clock podcast this episode. I think it's sort of obvious why we're tackling this now. The U.S. election is rapidly upon us, Canada and everywhere else, but the U.S. is experiencing a second wave. I say but the U.S. because the U.S. hasn't done its first wave, unfortunately, but people are struggling with the idea of uncertainty and the mind's tendency to go negative. The mind is built to focus on negative things, because if you have a false positive in terms of a negative, you live to worry another day. For those what is she saying? This may be a difficult podcast for you, because Mouse, I'm going to start so you can respond to a story from little Leanna's childhood days. Because
Alrighty.
This is something I didn't know there was a name for it, but this was something I did at a coping mechanism. I remember as far back as 12, you know, when there'd be a difficult test. I mean, I was in the gifted program. I was everybody's show pony because, you know, a book smart girl in a, you know, an underprivileged neighborhood, we can use her, you know. And so there's a lot of pressure put on me at a super young age to not just do well enough, but do better, you know. And contrary to what Eleanor Roosevelt said, no, being twice as good to be thought of half as well is actually difficult. And so I started getting a lot of anxiety. And so what I started doing, just, you know, based on reason, hence this being a critical thinking podcast, is go, all right, what's the worst that can happen? And how am I going to handle it when it does? And that's basically what negative visualization is. Of course, my mother, being extremely old school in this way, went, and it was the same nasal sing song every single time. Leanna, don't be negative, every single freaking time. And no matter how many times I said, I'm not being negative, I'm being prepared. I've never understood this idea that you just stick your head in the sand and hope for the best. It just seems so illogical for me. But at the same time, there is a right way and a wrong way to do premeditatio malorum. One can drive you completely crazy. One can give you a sense of resiliency. So, Mouse, I mean, this topic was your idea. So what did you want to let people know about this practice?
Well, here's the thing. So this is, as you said, this is very much a coping mechanism. This is what the Stoics would use in order to build emotional resilience. Mm-hmm. This is so that you would not become overwhelmed by all of the adversities that might come to you. As you know, the birth of the philosophy of Stoicism came from a disaster. Mm-hmm. Zeno, the creator of the school, was a merchant who lost absolutely everything in a shipwreck and was left absolutely penniless. Mm-hmm. And to him, he would say, you know, eventually he would say, it turns out that losing everything was my greatest fortune. The notion of premeditatio malorum is that we, as creatures who are capable of using our rational minds and are capable of responding to events with in a rational way, that we can condition ourselves. There is an astronaut who was asked, aren't you ever scared when something goes wrong, when you're out on a mission, mm-hmm. you're up, you know, you when you're major tumming all the way up there past the atmosphere? And the astronaut said, oh yeah, we get scared. Mm-hmm. Some of us even get super scared. I mean, we go in our suits for a reason. That was a joke that he made, but yeah. But we have trained ourselves to contemplate just about every eventuality of what might go wrong, that when something does go wrong, we have trained ourselves to act immediately.
Yeah,
that's, despite whatever fear we have.
That was, and okay, I love Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, but this is a concept kind of ruined by the Star Trek of Wrath of Khan, because that's what the Kobayashi Maru is based on, right?
And right.
What one of the big sort of failings of this is why I don't think cultural education replaces education. You know, even if someone is an autodidact, that's still not the same as just sort of existing in a cultural soup, because the whole purpose of Kirk cheating on the Kobayashi Maru is because later on he was ill-equipped to deal with failure. But that's not what the cultural understanding of that scene was. It was Kirk beat the Kobayashi Maru. He's cool. And yeah. I think there's no greater facile example of modern Western fragility than that kind of in microcosm, right? What the little morality play surrounding that was supposed to teach was the exact opposite to what people took from it. And I've thought about why this is so much. And I think that's because, if I'm right, you can correct me here, because you're more of a Stoicism expert than I am. The purpose of Stoicism is to sit and contemplate and get used to the sound of your own mind. It is not to not feel. And
yes.
I find a great many people are so busy repressing and suppressing any emotional reaction to anything that they are so far away from a state of stoicism that in order to get to that place, they'd have to wander through a forest of crazy filled with minefields of breakdowns. And they just, you know what I mean? They don't even want to contemplate that.
Yeah. Well, Seneca used to say that nothing to my way of thinking is a better proof of a well-ordered mind than a man's ability to stop just where he is and pass some time in his own company.
Yeah.
And a lot of people can't do that. A lot of people are terrified.
As has been shown by these COVID lockdowns.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, my husband and I, when this happened, we were bummed because we like going out to eat. We like going to movies, but we went, okay, well, we'll guess we'll just stay in forever or, you know, for however long it lasts. Because my husband, when he was a little kid, he, because of how unusual a child he was, as far as he was always a step ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. And he kind of lived 10 years in the future. Yeah. He used to, his mother would say, you don't need to worry about him when you're babysitting him. He can entertain himself. He always is capable of spending time with himself in his own company. And the same thing went for me. But there are several goals in the Stoic agenda, so to speak, when you practice the philosophy. The first one is, as you say, to become comfortable with the voice of your own mind. And that is the point. That is the point that is called the domestication. Yes.
Yeah, I've been mushing up words. I think it's fall brain.
Yeah. I need to have my basic big pumpkin latte.
Oh no, you're not on the pro pumpkin spice side, are you?
No, I'm more of the apple caramel cider.
Okay, that's more forgivable. I've gotten to the point where my stoicism has been disrupted. I can't even handle the smell of, it's not pumpkin spice. It's the smell of pumpkin spice and coffee mixed together. Like pumpkin spice tea, no problem. There is something just, like you said, overloaded. Pumpkin spice lattes overload my olfactory senses.
Right. That's why you get a cold cold cream, cold foam, cold brew pumpkin.
Because that's a Starbucks thing, right?
Yeah, that's a Starbucks thing. And it does not have that offensive nuclear smell that the latte does.
You know what I mean? That smell of Starbucks burnt coffee mixed with the pumpkin spice and then the high fructose corn syrup.
They pump
into it to mitigate the burned coffee bean. Obviously, this episode of the podcast is not brought to you by Starbucks. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because this is where I struggle with the whole thing, because I've actually found myself not having any problems with solitude. I'm awesome with that. I'm actually having trouble in the whole COVID situation of the number of people who want to hang out virtually. Mm-hmm. And then it's just, it's like an example. And this is just a joke. I do not believe in this, but it's an example of Sartre's Hell is Other People. Because
l'enfer des autres.
It's just inane babble that you cannot extract yourself from. And I just sit there feeling like I'm slowly dying inside. So I actually have to do exactly what Premeditatio Malorum dictates, that it's like, okay, this guy is going to babble ignorantly about politics. It's going to happen. How am I going to respond? And then I work through that. And this guy's going to get drunk and he's going to become a raging narcissist and not take turns talking. How is this going to be how am I going to handle it? And that's not me being nice. That's me knowing that it's a bunch of people who completely lack self-awareness, and they're going to blame me if I go, can all of you just shut up and be an adult for 5 seconds? Right? I know that's not possible.
That sounds like opera cast parties.
It's a lot of situations primarily staffed with shallow people, you mm-hmm. know? And the interesting thing is that they don't call it premeditatio malorum in PTSD therapy, but isolating what you can control and what is beyond your control is a major part of rebuilding back somebody after a trauma.
Right. PTSD therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, yeah. And a lot of those... cognitive behavioral therapy, they all have elements based on the Stoic philosophy.
I think DBT is probably closer than CBT. Dialectic behavioral therapy versus cognitive behavioral therapy, because in a lot of these instances, you have to go back to the story, the dialectic you tell yourself about a situation. As opposed to the cognitive response, that once that story has taken hold, that's it. You're on the train. There's no thinking yourself out of it once you're in the doom spiral, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, what's interesting about dialectic behavioral therapy, in other words, Stoicism, is that it is managing to treat conditions that were previously considered untreatable. And this is what I find so fascinating about the whole thing, and my whole issue with how critical thinking and philosophy are taught. Mouse has been subjected to me ranting very unstoically about the show The Good Place over the last week. I started binge watching it. I have issues. The going back to people like Seneca, like Zeno, like even Aristotle, there's a lot of wisdom there. And even going back to like Hillel the Elder and some of the Talmudic scholars, there's a lot of wisdom in those very, very old texts that newer academics take credit for, when in fact they're just saying the same ideas that have existed for millennia in a way that just seems more arrogant and less poetic and more cold, stark, wordy academia, as opposed to the language intended to lift that people like Seneca used. Obviously, it's brought to us in translation, but still, right? The construction is there. And and this is why I wanted to do a critical thinking podcast, because I find a lot of critical thinking ends up being, and this is why this is a good topic, it ends up being critical in that is it focuses on the toxic aspects of negativity instead of critical in engaging in cognitive faculties that allow you to get to the right answer using a combination of the facts at hand, induction and deduction. Right? Critical thinking has sunken into, well, you sound smarter when you're crapping on something. And it's led to a lot of shittiness. And I mean, this is going to be a bit of a tangent, but I think, again, I like to use pop culture things because let's face it, this is the internet. People like their pop culture. Also, search engine optimization. Show the Boys, right? The Boys is an example of post Watchmen, meaning the what did that come out in, like 1984? The comic book Watchmen, post Watchmen comic books, which when Alan Moore wrote The Watchmen, he had no intention of making comics descend into nihilism.
Yeah, right? it was not a genre that he wanted to create.
No, he was trying to just he was trying to do a critical thinking exercise on certain heroic archetypes, right? Be it, you know, Mr. A being Steve Ditko's version of Ayn Rand, which is nothing at all objectivist. It's just, again, nihilist. And, you know, this idea.
Steve had some issues.
Yes. yes. Brilliant guy.
But the problem that can arise with objectivism is that you need to have a very strong emotional foundation. And this is where Stoicism, I think, is a perfect philosophy for starters, because emotions are very tricky. Yeah. And if you fall into the straw Vulcan argument, which a lot of people, it's the notion that emotions need to be suppressed, which Ayn Rand never stated that you need to suppress your emotions and your feelings. She said that emotions are not tools of cognition, they're tools of reaction. That is, you know how you feel about something, but you don't know, if you go strictly by emotions, you don't know why. You need to introspect and try to find out if whether your response to something is appropriate or not.
Right.
Because if you're having a response that is not a response that is not appropriate to what is going on, then you know that there's work to be done. You know that there's an underlying issue there.
Right.
However, a lot of people who read the philosophy go and create straw Vulcans of themselves. They instead go for, and this is with a small s, the Stoic man of the 1950s, who was not actually a Stoic.
Right.
It was just a bundle of suppression and repression.
Yeah.
And that was Steve, unfortunately.
I mean, the issue with Randian rational selfishness is if too many people, and this is what happened to Steve Ditko, remove the rationality from the equation, and so he just ended up with irrational selfishness, and it's all through the Mr. A stuff.
It's the notion that, you know, if, because you are embracing a philosophy that holds reason at its center, you start falling into the error of thinking that everything you do and everything you think must be rational,
right? Which is irrational.
It's a psychological thing some people do, and so, you know, Steve and many others, instead of becoming objectivists, they become objectivists, as I call them, because that is how somebody becomes a rampant raging asshole.
Nihilists, right? We get back to that nihilism. Nihilism is sort of the ground floor of philosophy, because it's easy.
It's not so much nihilism as there comes this strong misanthropic vein.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
This strong misanthropic vein, because, and here's the thing, a lot of people come to objectivism after rejecting something like, say, conservatism or a religious extremism. It's very, very frequent. And they often think that by embracing the philosophy, they're kind of turning their back on the things that they used to feel and the things that they used to think, and they want to do better. But because, you know, they start from the point of suppressing their emotions,
yeah,
all that happens is that all of those little goblins go into the basement,
right?
And they sneak up through the chimney, and next thing they know, they're up in the attic throwing a party. It becomes a subconscious. It becomes, by suppressing them, they become subconscious forces that kind of ensure that you will do exactly the thing that you were trying to avoid. But right, with the coat of rationalization, because you're not confronting your demons.
Right. And that's why, you know, I say, you know, the show The Boys is quite instructive in that regard, because it's taking all the hope and change, for lack of a better term, out of superheroes, which is why I say it's a show for our time. And it's post hope and change, because of course, mm-hmm. and it just seems distrustful of any power at all. And, you know, this idea that every powerful person in that show is somehow, I can't even say morally corrupt anymore, because that's now a wonderful character in Doom Patrol. And I utterly love Doom Patrol. Right. So like, and it's interesting.
Would you say that Doom Patrol is the anti-Boys?
It really is. I think if I'd seen The Good Place before I saw Doom Patrol, I would like it much better, because Doom Patrol is basically a show of a bunch of characters in purgatory confronting the terrible things they did in the past. But it has such an affirming ultimate trajectory that it makes you feel good instead of just bombarding you with shock the way so many shows do now. And, you know, the show Westworld was going the same way at first, but then something happened. I think Westworld became a thing and started listening to his critics and lost its idealism. Unlike the original show from that creative team, Person of Interest, which is a wonderful, wonderful show. But you know, what these shows are all about is people sort of trying to get by as flawed human beings against seemingly insurmountable odds. The Watchmen TV show that they made as a sequel to the books is also in this category. There's a lot of superhero fiction that's coming out that's sort of, it's studying superhero fiction, but they're all doing it in kind of different ways. And I think that what that kind of says about our culture, my professors would have smacked me for that sentence. What I think that says about our culture is that we are in an age that is inherently afraid of centralized power. We are afraid of power so great that there is no check on it. And our fiction is trying to figure out what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And some shows handle that a lot better than others. And I really do think Doom Patrol does it very, very well, which is why it's so unfortunate that it's on HBO Max. And so very few people are seeing it. It's out on DVD now, if people wanted to order it on DVD, because it's almost childlike, which is what I find so delightful about a show that deals with sex magic in places. And like it goes some really real places. There's a Nazi puppet show at one point, but then they have a runner with Animal, Vegetable, Mineral Man. It is delightfully absurdist, and yet it does not have the nihilism of The Boys, and The Boys is textbook nihilism in it pretty much says all values are baseless, nothing can be known, right? It's power for power's sake. This is all just obedience versus chaos. There's no such thing as good. Whereas other shows, I think I'm glad I'm seeing them lean into goodness actually being a thing, because I think we are so in despair right now as a culture that, and this is where I think certain stoic exercises can help, because at the core of stoicism, I maintain, is the belief that the rational, categorical imperative, if you will, is that things will work out because we'll all be dead eventually. I mean, that really is the core of it, right? Like, yes, no matter what, this has an end point.
Yeah, one of Marcus Aurelius's quotes is that soon enough you will forget everything, and in a little while everything will forget you.
Yes, and people are like, oh God, that's so depressing. But the older I get, the more it's like, that's another way of saying this will be a funny story someday.
Yeah.
I think when you hit a point in your life where you realize you've forgotten more than you remember, there's a sense of peace.
It is. One of the Stoic exercises is the contemplation of your own death. Mm-hmm. And it is not a morbid, fatalistic exercise as much as it is an exercise to be at peace with something that will eventually come, because part of Stoicism is to be ready.
Right.
To be ready and to have tranquility. It is not, as many people think, disregarding the value of things. A Stoic knows the value of a lot of things. However, one of the primary points that Marcus Aurelius makes, and this is a man who lived through the Antonine Plague.
Yeah.
This is a man who openly wept when he would see his citizens die, when he would see his children and his relatives die, but he would accept it, not saying it's inevitable, because he tried whatever he could do.
Right.
Help people. And of course, medicine in that time was incredibly rudimentary. So the Antonine Plague lasted for 15 years.
Right.
But we were talking about a leader who didn't leave Rome when many, many fled, because it was a gigantic focus of plague. He, in fact, at one point found out that the treasury was completely bankrupt, mm-hmm. and he auctioned off his own imperial possessions
right.
to raise money for plague victims. But the notion that the Stoic has concerning death and loss and his own death is you have to treasure the things and the people that you have
right.
at the moment as that when they exist, and remember that when they leave, you shouldn't say I lost it, but
right.
I have given it back, because everything you have on earth is just being lent to you for a time.
And that is the core of what I think gives comfort. That it's not that you made a mistake and lost something. It's that it was always fleeting. It was always temporary.
Yeah.
And I think getting in that mindset encourages people to actually, that cliche performer term, be in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that modern education systems, which you've talked about so much on this podcast, I know I'm beating a dead horse, but it's important. They train people not to savor those moments, because life, you can only live life one moment at a time. And everybody starts worrying about their friggin' SAT scores when they're in like what, the seventh grade. You are training. That's a great way to develop an anxiety condition. Sure enough.
Yes.
Right? Like, you should not have to prepare for a single test 10 years in advance. That's nuts. That's delayed gratification is a good thing. That's too delayed. Because and I mean, parents start worrying about where a kid's going to go to college when they're applying for preschool. That is frigging insane. Too much can change in the world, right? Yeah.
Like Seneca said, you lose the day in expectation of the night and the night in expectation, in fear of the morning.
There you go. And that's what people have done, right? The period of relative stability that the world experienced due to, ironically, the Cold War, created about three generations of people who weren't looking towards the horizon in a good Luke Skywalker way, looking to the horizon, fearing what will happen if they never get there. And the thing is, you can never get to the horizon, dummy. It's the horizon, right? Yeah. And so now that things have derailed to a certain extent, people are freaking out about their kids missing 4 months of school. And this is where, you know, as you said, leaders who have suffered hardship are so important, that someone who has come through something and successfully navigated that and can now provide wisdom for it is a better leader than somebody who has never really had to face a moment where they were powerless. And I think that's an important leadership quality that we have really dismissed in this. You must have an utterly perfect transcript, not a single blemish. That's not the mark of achievement. That's a mark of a lack of adversity. And we have promoted luck as opposed to resilience or competence. And now that's coming due. That was in terms of society, that was Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff and not looking down yet. Well,
yeah,
COVID caused us to look down, right? It's that stop.
It is that stop. And, you know, it's an interesting point about that. Zeno would often talk about people who would advise you to run away from adversity and trials. And he said, you know, if you're telling me that I should sail the world, but I should avoid unfavorable winds, the potential of shipwreck, the potential of being stranded, the potential of ending up in the wrong location, you're essentially telling me not to sail.
Right. Exactly. And that's the message. That's the message out of academic institutions, out of our politicians, you know, just all the way down the chain. That's the message. And that's not possible.
Nope.
You know, the problem with our world is our world insists on heavily punishing risks and then demanding people take them. No wonder everybody's so stressed.
It's a nonsense burger, to be honest, because, for example, how do you expect someone who has never had to deal, who has never contemplated, say, for example, losing a relative, how are you expecting them to deal with that when the time comes? Because the time will come. No matter how much we hate the notion, we are going to lose someone, or that is, you know, we're going to have to give someone back.
Right.
As a kid, one of the things I never, ever wanted to contemplate was the death of my mother, because we were so close. And I was always afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But that some illness would take her away. Or that because she lived in a country that is dangerous, that she would be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that she would encounter her, and in a violent way. And that was something that always perturbed me. But then she was diagnosed with cancer, and she beat it the first time. And so I thought, okay, well, this is done. And then, of course, she was diagnosed with cancer again 5 years later. And it was very fast. She was diagnosed at the Anderson in May, and by October she was gone. It was very, very fast. And at that point, as I was flying to Ecuador, knowing that she was going to die, I had an option. I had a choice. Because I was going to the bedside of my dying mother, I had the option of essentially turning it into a Greek tragedy, of crying my eyes out by her side, basically do everything possible, or indulge in every display of emotion that will only make her passing more difficult for her. Or I could prepare myself. And try to make her passing as... I'm looking for a word here, because I can't say enjoyable, because it's not something you enjoy.
Well, the typical words are peaceful, right?
Yeah, but to make her passing as smooth as possible.
Smooth is a good word, yeah.
So by July, I knew that she was going to die. And I was arranging for plane tickets, because the chemotherapy, she started responding to the chemotherapy very well. But because she was so petite and so slight, the chemotherapy just took it out of her. By the end, she just didn't have the energy. And so they stopped the chemotherapy. And so at that point, I thought, what can I do? And I found a book. Let me actually bring it up, because if someone who is experiencing what I went through might find it useful. Let me see here. I'm opening my Kindle app right now, because it's okay. So it's called Grieving. It's that thing when the results pop up, and then the app decides, oh, there's another book that matches, and
spend money.
Well, it plunks five more of your library, and then it moves everything around. I have about 524 books on my Kindle library. So I'm one of those. We used to live in an apartment that had one room exclusively dedicated to being our library. That's how bad we are.
We're trying to purge books right now, and it's not going well. It's just not.
So the book is called Grieving the Death of a Mother by Harold Ivan Smith. And it was the first book that I read that that acknowledges, you know, grieving takes its own time, its own, it takes its own pace. And you cannot hurry it up. The people who tell you that you need to be done grieving by a year or 2 years are essentially just blowing smoke out of their ass. You don't need to listen to them.
Well, it's not linear either, right?
It's not linear, because after the person is gone, you will find something that reminds you of them, and then you get ambushed by grief, as it is called. And so I read this book, and it helped me a lot. And people think, you know, that means that it made the pain go away. It gave me tools with which to deal with the pain, so that when I was there, the focus was not on how I was dealing with the situation, but it was about how my mother was passing, about trying to tie loose ends, about talking, about being there with my father, with my Aunt Mariana, who was my last remaining aunt, and whom I unfortunately lost this year to COVID.
I thought that's who it was.
And the notion that once it is done, you never grieve again. It's not true. No. And the notion that the Stoic would repress his feelings, it's not true. You will cry. You will find this, oh, if I could only see, show it to my mother.
Yeah.
And you will suddenly feel, oh, and it's okay. It's okay to cry. It's okay to grieve. Mm-hmm. It's not okay to cling to that grief and
right.
say, you know, stay here for the next 20 years. Even though for the next 20 years, you will miss that person. You will have moments where you go, oh, you might shed a tear. You might cry.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you're going to find. Like my father, for example, found a cache of photos of my mother when she was young. One of them is her wedding photos. And all of those are also when she was a bridesmaid for my for my dad's current wife.
Right.
Who they were friends. My dad, my mother died. And then a year after, my father married someone who was a friend of my mother's.
My uncle did that. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, it's interesting many ways because it's funny. The story is funny because my mom actually was not dating my dad in high school. She was dating someone else. And my dad was dating Crystal, his current wife. Mm-hmm. And both of them fought and broke up with their respective romantic partners. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up together.
Right.
But so then my mother dies, but Crystal's husband had died of cancer 7 years prior.
Oof.
And so she sort of knew how it was.
Right.
And my dad was having a very hard time. He turned the house into a shrine for my mother.
Wow.
He wouldn't touch any of my mother's things. My mother's ashes were in her bedroom, mm-hmm. which, you'll find this funny. So the Catholic Church has ruled that keeping a person's ashes in the home is improper and it's idolatrous, apparently. And of course, I went, what the fuck is wrong with you?
When did they do that?
I forget. It was fairly recent. It was around the time my mom died.
Okay.
And so,
but you know, the Bible is immutable and unchanging on everything but the things they want to change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then, Crystal started visiting my dad because she was concerned because he was very, very, very depressed. And in the process of her consoling him, they sparked up their relationship again. And he was terrified to tell me that he was getting married.
Interesting.
And he kind of like started joking about it, hinting about it. And I was like, okay.
Right.
Like, I think he was expecting me to react in a very, very strong way. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't care if that's what makes you happy. We know Crystal. She's been a friend of the family forever. And what's going to, you know, why do you think my mom's going to rise from the grave like Fruma Sarah? I don't think so.
Right.
Because I went, you know, this is not about my mom anymore. It's about your happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, coming from a Catholic country, tongues wagged. Oh my
really?
God. There were people who were in the circle, not necessarily friends of my mother, one of them was, who kept, at the year anniversary, year anniversary of my mother's death.
Right.
You know, you have to do the 3 month anniversary mass and then the 6 months and then the year and then you're done.
Okay.
They have to do a mass. It's a Catholic thing.
Yeah. I mean, the Jewish cutoff is a year too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As my dad was walking out of the church after that ceremony was done, for which I sang the Ave Maria, I recorded it so it would be played because I couldn't be there in person. He overheard these people just gossiping up a blue streak about how improper it was.
I never understand people who gossip near churches.
I know. And it was, and it's honestly, and I wish I had been there, because then I would have said to this person in question, first of all, this is none of your damn business.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the one getting married. And it's you're not the one getting married. And if you ask the family members, I think my brother and I will tell you that we prefer to have our father, one, married to someone he already knows,
mm-hmm.
instead of a 25-year-old who might be a gold digger,
right?
Or have unauspicious interests at hand,
right?
We would rather have him married and happy,
right,
than dying of a heart attack in the next 5 years, as is very common with married men who widow.
Yeah,
who become widowers.
Yeah. Now, not your business, right?
Not your business, not your monkey, not your circus.
This is all making me think of, very, very powerful story, obviously. And it's making me think of like permission structures and permission structures for grief, and how, the allegedly dominant culture in North America is kind of the only one that doesn't have some nod to the fact that grief is not linear, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's Días de los Muertos in
Mexico.
There's the yard site in Judaism, but this kind of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant tradition doesn't have that ability to, you have one day a year to to feel whatever you want to feel. Right. And it gives you are able to know it's coming. This is the appropriate time to do this, so that mm-hmm. it doesn't control you the rest of the time, or it doesn't control you at times where you kind of need control back. Right. And, it makes me think about with the U.S. election upcoming and the two very different narratives of the two candidates, and people like making politics about policy, but let's face it, it's really not, because again, things change. You're voting mm-hmm. for a person, and you're voting for a person's decision-making ability, right? Because let's face it, especially in the US system, it's very hard to get legislation passed. So you want that incremental legislation to be rightly thought out. Right. And so you've got one guy who talks very openly about the death of his first wife and the loss of his son. And you can tell it gets to him. He's emotionally connected to that. And then you've got another candidate who believes that's all weakness. Trump clearly has issues with death. His brother died, and I think everybody's practically forgotten about that already, because it didn't seem to mean terribly much to him. But then he turns around and attacks Biden's remaining son. And America has become so repressed that half the country, well, at least 30% of the country, I won't say half, but at least 30% of the country doesn't see the problem there. You don't go after somebody's kids. Your kids aren't running for president, right? So I think that's a big marker of emotional repression in North America right now. And I think, Mouse, you touched on it with the stuff about your dad, that it is tied to that kind of post-war masculinity mm-hmm. that we don't have time to unpack, because that's a topic in and of itself. But there is definitely something about expecting, and I don't know when the cutoff is. It's boys are sort of raised to not feel, I think, from the cradle, but it's an issue, because then you have a bunch of people with absolutely zero emotional intelligence, right? And every feeling becomes a completely overwhelming one, because all they're trying to do is pack it down to not feel. Feeling is bad. Feeling is weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Feelings are And this is where I get into, I don't like Immanuel Kant.
Yeah.
Feelings are our proto-reasoning. It's like you said, it's reactive, right? But
right.
But reasoning is our way of going, okay, why do I feel this way? What do I do about feeling this way? Is this a useful feeling or is this an antisocial reaction feeling, right? Feelings always happen first and then the reason happens. We know this, we've measured in the brain. Feelings happen faster than cognitive processes. We can't do anything about that. So this idea that human beings are purely rational human beings that don't, we can somehow bypass that emotional response, that's bloody absurd, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of my issues with Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment philosophy are that you didn't see in the Greeks. The Greeks were like, yeah, we have feelings. You know, I mean, Greeks had the whole idea of catharsis, right? Mm-hmm. And
the whole thing that the Greek tragedy is based on.
Right, is just getting it out.
Yeah, and you see Medea get killed, you get it out, you weep, you cry, then you go home and laugh.
Yeah, and I mean, you see elements of that in the modern day Black church, mm-hmm. the call and answer format, the religious experience idea. It's a form of catharsis. It's more a joy catharsis, but you know the way certain Black people in America right now are publicly grieving is another sign of strength through being okay with being emotional, authentically emotional in places people can see it. And I think that's one of the things that's really scaring establishment America right now, because there is a huge amount of power in being able to do that. You know, and they say constantly that they're concerned that the whole thing is going to become performative, but I don't think that's happened yet. I think that, you know, Black America right now is in an exercise they've been doing on and off since, you know, the Martin Luther King civil rights era, and actually going back to Sojourner Truth and her mm-hmm. Ain't I a Woman speech, right? Yep. They have to grieve in public. They have to reconnect with the pain of their experience over and over and over again, because that is an indicator that North American society is on the wrong track. No group of people en masse should be feeling this kind of pain. The problem is, because we're collectively a bunch of emotional, you know, children, the response is not, wow, I can relate to that pain. This isn't good. Let's get stronger together, right? It's, well, I have pain too. Why doesn't mine count, mm-hmm. right? And that's the backfiring we're seeing in poor to middle class white America. They have been convinced that their pain doesn't matter. So they are resentful of people they see as having pain that does matter. And that's the impasse that needs to be overcome. And, you know, I don't think Joe Biden going out there and telling a story over and over and over again is going to solve that. But at least it's a start. At least it's a guy who is modeling good behavior in that regard, instead of Trump's, I don't know what the hell that is.
It's a Grand Guignol spectacle at this point.
You know what?
It's grotesque.
It is grotesque. It is. Grotesque is the only way to put it. It's a guy who is clearly so controlled by his passions. I've been trying to figure out if he's King Lear or Richard III.
I would say King George at this point.
You know what? I made a King George reference the other day to a guy, and he said, oh, that's ironic. It's like, if mm-hmm. only it were so simple to chalk it up to Porfiria, you know, if only there was something physically wrong with Trump that we can kind of go, all right, this all makes sense. I think it's much, much deeper.
Oh, it is much deeper.
Yeah. I think it's the post-war. I think it's post-war false masculinity coming home to roost. Again, that's a topic for another time. Getting uh-huh. back to sort of this collective what do we do if this isn't rock bottom? You know, what do we do if it does get worse? Because let's face it, like a lot of people are, I know a lot of people who every time they see a positive poll for Biden, they freak out because they can't trust it. And I know some people who are very, very frightened that Biden's election will mean socialism comes to America. It's easy to dismiss that as absurd, but the fear is real, right?
I grew up in a socialist country.
Exactly. Exactly. Like I do not want to minimize people who, you know, I went to school with a lot of people who lived under either Soviet communism, Latin American socialism, or, you know, various African countries and their really messed up structure that they, you know, claim to be socialism, but it's there's those systems are so corrupt that it's hard to say they're anything. And then people who got out of communist China, right?
I can tell you, for those who fear that Biden might bring socialism, I grew up in a socialist country, and the most recent before the current president, whose name is Lenin, by the way. I'm like, oh God, that kind of gives you an idea of what Ecuador's. the president right before this one, Rafael Correa. Mm-hmm. If you take a moment, take a breather, and then you go and take a look at his television appearances, you take a look at his national rhetoric, you take a look at how he attacked newspapers, how he went on Twitter wars with people who criticized him. Those of you who are afraid that Biden might bring socialism to America, I hate to break it to you, but Trump is a Marxist. Trump is a socialist. There is no such thing as a capitalist who will tell you that you need to institute protectionism and to curtail trade and to punish people for trading. Those are things that happen in a centrally managed economy.
You know what's messed up about that, though? Mm-hmm. Leftists then claim Trump that the globalists, the liberal corporatists, are responsible for Trump because Trump was a natural response to globalism, which at some point on the social left became incompatible with human rights, which is baffling to me. But there's actually an extremist circle jerk going on right now. You're 100% right. It's just really interesting to see how the two extremes are fueling each other right now. It's like this messed up, not at all Taoist yin and yang.
It's a Tao of evil.
Yeah, it's like the inverted Tao. It's like neon pink and neon purple or neon pink and neon green instead of black and white. But
it's the wow.
Yeah, there is this. Like the political extremes are feeding off each other because obviously both can only continue to exist if the other agrees to fight, right? It's the Antifa Proud Boys thing. Mm-hmm. If one day one side just didn't show up, well, there wouldn't be a brawl that day, would there? They'd start picking on regular people. The cops would intervene very, very quickly, and it would be pretty clear who the problem was there. Mm-hmm. Those two extremes are feeding each other. But, you know, I've been finding myself thinking about this a lot in response to, you know, liberal activists completely shitting their pants. There's no other way to put it. Apologize for the swears. About the Supreme Court right now. And I've been doing the whole, you know, negative visualization about that. Like, all right, Coney Barrett gets seated. Supreme Court has a conservative bent. Biden doesn't add new justices, which I think is the right call. Just because if he adds two more, then we all know what happened. We saw it with the filibuster, right? They removed the Democrats removed the filibuster for everything but the Supreme Court. McConnell removes it for the Supreme Court the minute he can, and this is why we're in this mess to begin with. So, all right, we've got a conservative court until Thomas leaves, most likely. Clarence Thomas is the most likely next replacement, but who knows, right? Like, Elena Kagan could, you know, God forbid, have a stroke or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at the age of various people, and okay, for a while we have a conservative court. And look at the power base that social conservatives have been able to build railing against the court. An allegedly liberal-leaning Supreme Court hasn't done all that much in terms of making a great liberal paradise social progress kind of thing, right? It's been very incremental. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is an opportunity to return the U.S. government to the way it's supposed to work, which is the legislative branch makes laws, the executive branch signs off on the law, and the judicial branch is a check against that. Instead of relying completely on the judicial branch for protecting the human rights of America, this is a shining opportunity to actually make legislation work, which, in the immortal words of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, is the best way to do it. She was spot on when she said that she feared that Roe v. Wade would actually undermine the pro-choice movement long-term by doing it through the courts instead of doing it through legislation. So I don't understand why liberals are screaming about court packing when in fact they should be going, okay, we need to figure out how to draft legislation that protects marriage equality, that protects all these other rights legislatively that can pass a conservative Supreme Court that they have no way of arguing is unconstitutional. It's doable. You know, an amendment, probably difficult right now, but legislation, doable. Let's focus on that. You only get there if you actually dare to contemplate the worst case scenario here. That's how negative visualization works. It works. It makes you a more rational strategist. Absolutely. You know, and if you use the dog Latin premeditatio malorum, it's a Harry Potter spell that J.K. Rowling should use. Her whole thinking is catastrophizing, right?
Yeah.
Like it's absurd. If you actually look at, okay, so men are allowed to dress like women in change rooms, and that's still a crime. Right? Like nothing is preventing someone like that from doing that right now. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you actually, what's the worst that could happen? Oh, okay. It's really not that bad. I mean, that's probably something we should clarify, that that this practice, that premeditatio malorum, is not an exercise in catastrophizing. It's an exercise in what's reasonably the worst case.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. It serves in as. It actually serves in several different ways. It prepares you for what is feasibly likely to happen as a worst case scenario, but it also, when done correctly, also helps you realize that you might be overreacting. About just how bad it can get.
Yeah, what I find it does most effectively is it stops that fight or flight response from happening in the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's one person I have to deal with on a fairly regular basis who I have to keep reminding myself is not a bad person. They are just extremely socially awkward, and they say things that in other contexts, someone would play referee and say, you can't speak to people that way. That's not one of these contexts. So I have to constantly prepare myself for interactions with this person by going like, he's going to push your buttons, right? It doesn't mean what it would mean from someone else. Do not react. That's a losing, you know, that's a losing scenario.
Scenario.
Right? That's how it works, because we are, one of the things I'm finding with me in this whole kind of Me Too, post Me Too thing, it's created a sort of, oh, I can just call out injustice wherever I see it right now, right? No, no, you can't, because a lot of people still don't realize how a great many messages are received.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have to give people who I mean, a lot of these people, a lot of them are men, women have different ways of being antisocial, but people who say these bludgeoning statements in work situations, they saw that modeled by male authority figures, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they took that behavior from somewhere. So you have to remind yourself, it's not their fault. And if you actually do want to change things, you have to set an alternative, better example and actually persuade that it is better. And acting like a combative lunatic and just getting everyone's adrenaline up, that causes people to go into defensive crouches, protective crouches, not places, you know, the risk immune state, as mm-hmm. as they call it. Man, that's a topic for another time. I'm just writing down topics because so many tangents, right? I mean,
right.
And this is the issue with really reductive looks at philosophy, where people think they can go, oh, we're going to deal with Immanuel Kant this week, and this is what he thought. Ta-da-da. Everything intersects with everything. No piece of human thought was created out of nothing. There is no a priori thought, right? No one knows what was the thought. What was the first thought ever thought by a human ever? We don't know, right? So we're all
existing. You cannot make those assumptions. Otherwise, you look like a giant a posteriori.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I see what you did there.
That was bad.
Yeah,
was bad.
I mean, all philosophy is the original Star Wars that starts saying episode 4, right? Mm-hmm. And here's your story already in progress. And that's something to really keep in mind when people, and Mouse, you talk about this all the time, people want to so tightly control things that mm-hmm. they end up breaking things instead of finding a way to work with them, right? You know, mm-hmm. most of the things we cherish, most of the things we give value to are actually quite fragile. And if you crush the life out of it because you don't want to drop it, you're going to break it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I mean, that to me in a nutshell is basically what negative visualization does. It gives you that test run so that in the moment you don't freak out and break the priceless vase that is certain relationships in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But of course that means admitting that every individual has sensitivities. That means validating the sensitivity. And that's where we start losing people, because they start going, what? No, I'm rational. It's that, what did you call straw Vulcan?
Yeah, the straw Vulcan.
We got to do one episode where I take issue with the whole Star Trek depiction of Vulcans.
Yes.
Drives me crazy.
It's the issue that I have with how people receive the depiction is that they always take it out of context.
Yes.
The fact that the Vulcans are the way they are because, and I don't understand, a lot of the Vulcan backstory doesn't make sense because they would not have survived.
Well, they've also retconned the shit out of Vulcan so many times, because all of modern Star Trek is just Spock fanboy fan fiction.
Yeah.
Like, Discovery is, the new movies are. they don't recognize what they were doing with that Kirk Spock McCoy triangle, and now it's just all Spock all the time. Spock is all the things.
The Spock network.
Yeah.
But the thing I have the issue with is that you see the backstory doesn't the backstory of them as a culture doesn't make sense because they supposedly have such strong emotions because of their brain chemistry essentially that they have to suppress their emotions because otherwise they will kill each other It doesn't make sense because if, as a culture, you have that strong of a reaction and you are so naturally prone to violence, you will have killed each other before even Surak would have arrived. Would have come around.
Yeah, yeah. They were. Star Trek was a collection of trolley problems back in the day, and it was just setting things up to kind of make a point from a very 60s. Liberal framework, but that's all it really was. And it's so funny because people who are like, I don't want moralizing in my Star Trek. Did you see the original Star Trek?
Like, hello, City on the Edge of Tomorrow.
I don't think people recognize how bold a statement, though, it was to have a Black person, a person with an Eastern European accent, a Japanese dude, and, you know, the various other members of the and an alien, on the bridge of essentially what's a U.S., military vessel. That wasn't done in the 60s. We don't realize that Kirk and Uhura was
kissing.
was possibly the first interracial kiss on television.
One of the first.
Yeah. That's how much the world has changed.
And as much as I have a beef with William Shatner, because he tends to go cuckoo, I will give him the credit that he fought to keep that kiss. He sabotaged, for people who don't know the story, the network wanted to do two versions of the scene, one with the kiss and one without. So they would not offend people. Because Kirk and Uhura were kissing and there was an interracial kiss and back in that day or whatever. Well, William Shatner, and in this case, I will definitely say bless his soul, was not okay with that. And he sabotaged the take when they did the, and I don't know how he managed to get away with this without them noticing, but in all of the takes that do not have the kiss, he crossed his eyes. Mm-hmm. And they noticed it in post and they went, well, we can't use this. He's crossing his eyes. So they had to air the kiss all across the US.
Right. Right. And I talked to a doctor who was originally from South Africa, who was inspired to come to America because he saw that. It was a powerful, powerful moment about how, yes, culture does not produce legislation, but culture can inspire legislators to do the right thing and create moral permission structures. We've got topics.
We have to.
4 weeks now, because I'm adding moral permission structures to the list. I think that's a good place to wrap because we're just generating topics right now, right? I'm like, no, don't get into that right now. Don't. I'm negatively visualizing how much longer this podcast will go if we do any more tangents. I am going to be stoic and stop. This has been the Broken Clock podcast on the FU Network. If you like this stuff, give us a few bucks on, it seems people prefer one-time donations on PayPal to Patreon. That is awesome. We'll work for tips. FUnetwork.tv is the place for all of that, as well as the FU Gazette, where you can see written articles that Mouse is going to do one eventually, because I'm going to keep twisting his arm. Mouse can negatively visualize what I'm going to do to him if he doesn't do a Gazette.
I do plan on writing one. I already have a topic in mind. I just need to flesh it out.
Mouse is just doing the thing that all proper philosophers do, procrastinating. And on that note, we're going to wrap. Mouse, as usual, you have the last word.
And I would like to end with a quote from Marcus Aurelius. It's time you realize that you have something in you more powerful and miraculous than the things that affect you and make you dance like a puppet.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yep.